An Osho Talk. The Book of Wisdom talks on Atisha's 7 points of mind training, number 25.
You should find freedom by means of both examination and investigation. Don't brag. Don't be consumed by jealousy. Don't act capriciously. Don't expect thanks. This quintessential lecture of advice, by which the advancement of the five decays is changed into the Bodhi path, is transmitted through Dharmakirti. By awakening the karmic energy of previous training, and by virtue of my intense interest, I ignored misery and bad reputation and sought instruction to control ego clinging. Now, even when I die, I'll have no regret.
Man's greatest longing is for freedom. Man is a longing for freedom. Freedom is the very essential core of human consciousness. Love is its circumference. And freedom is its center. These two fulfilled, life has no regret. And they both are fulfilled together, never separately. People have tried to fulfill love without freedom. Then love brings more and more misery, more and more bondage. Then love is not what one has expected it to be. It turns out just the opposite. It shatters all hopes. It destroys all expectations. And life becomes a wasteland. A groping in darkness and never finding the door. Love without freedom naturally tends to be possessive. And the moment possessiveness enters in, you start creating bondage for others and bondage for yourself. Because you cannot possess somebody without being possessed by him. You cannot make somebody a slave without becoming a slave yourself. Whatsoever you do to others is done to you. This is the basic principle to be understood, that love without freedom never brings fulfillment. And there have been people who have tried the other extreme, freedom without love. These are the monks, the escapists, the people who renounce the world, afraid of love. Afraid of love because it brings bondage. they renounce all the situations where love can flow, grow, can happen, is possible. They escape into loneliness. Their loneliness never becomes aloneness. It remains loneliness. And loneliness is a negative state. It is utterly empty. It is said, one can be a solitary, but that does not bring solitude. Solitariness is just physical aloneness. Solitude is spiritual aloneness. If you are just lonely, and you will be if you have renounced the world, if you have escaped from the world out of fear, you will be lonely. The world will haunt you. And all kinds of desires will surround you. You will suffer millions of nightmares, because whatsoever you have renounced cannot be dropped so easily. Renunciation is repression and nothing else. And the more you repress a thing, the more you need to repress it. And the more you go on repressing it, the more powerful it becomes. It will erupt in your dreams. It will erupt in your hallucinations. People living in the monasteries start hallucinating. People going to the Himalayan caves sooner or later are no more in contact with reality. They start creating a reality of their own, a private reality, a fictitious reality. The Christian will talk to Christ in his lonely cave. He creates Christ just so that he can have somebody there, just so that he is not lonely. And many methods have been developed by these monks how to hallucinate. If you fast, hallucination becomes easier. The body becomes weaker. You start losing control over reality. The more the body is weak, the more is the possibility of hallucination. People in fever, illness, start hallucinating. The same rule. Torture the body, weaken the body, starve the body, and hallucinations will be easier. You can have Jesus Christ, or Krishna, or Gautam Buddha. Great company you can have, but it is all imagination. The Hindu will never see Christ, and the Christian will never see Krishna. You will see only whatsoever you believe in. You will see only whatsoever you create by your belief. It is a projection. It will be difficult to project it in the marketplace, because there will be so many people who will deny your projection. They will take you to the psychiatrist. They will think you have gone nuts. If you start talking to the Christ in the marketplace, you will end up in some hospital. But in the Himalayan cave, there is nobody else. You are free to create whatsoever you want to your heart's content. Loneliness is such a misery that one starts believing in one's own hallucinations to have company. But this is madness. On the one hand is the person, the worldly person, who has tried to find love without freedom and has failed. His life is nothing but a long, long slavery of many, many people, of many, many things. He is chained, body, mind, soul. He is not free to have even a slight movement. That is one failure. The majority of humanity is caught in that extreme. Few escape from the world, seeing the misery. They start searching the other extreme. Freedom, moksha, nirvana. But they become neurotic, psychotic. They start living in their own dreams. Loneliness is so much that one has to create something to be with. Both these extreme efforts have failed. Hence, humanity stands on a crossroads. Where to go? The past has utterly failed. All the efforts that we have done in the past proved wrong, led to cul-de-sac. Now, where to go? What to do? Atisha has an important message to deliver to you. And that is the message of all the Buddhas, of all the enlightened people of the world. They say, love and freedom are not two separate things. You cannot choose. Either you will have to have both, or you will have to have dropped both. But you cannot choose, you cannot have one. Love is the circumference. Freedom is the center. One has to grow in such delicate balance where love and freedom can bloom together. And they can. Because in few rare individuals it has happened. And if it has happened to only a single individual in the whole history, it can happen to every human being. It is your potential, your birthright. Meditation is the balance. Meditation is the bird with two wings, freedom and love. My effort here in this Buddha field is to give you both the wings together. Be loving and be free. Be loving and be non-possessive. Be free, but don't become cold. Remain warm, warm with love. Your freedom and your love have to grow hand in hand, in deep embrace, in a kind of dance, helping each other. And then the total man is born, who lives in the world and is not of the world at all. Then the man is born in whom extremes meet and merge and become complementaries. Then the man is rich. Just to love without freedom is to be impoverished. Or just to be free without love is to live in loneliness, sadness, darkness. Freedom is needed for love to grow. Love is needed so that freedom can be nourished. My sannyasin has to remember constantly not to choose between these two. Both have to be absorbed together, digested together. Love has to become your circumference, your action, and freedom has to become your being, your center, your soul. The first sutra, you should find freedom by means of both examination and investigation. Freedom can be of three types. And those three types have to be understood well. The first is freedom from. The second is freedom for. And the third is just freedom. Neither from nor far. The first freedom from is a reaction. It is past oriented. You are fighting against the past. You want to get rid of it. You are obsessed with it. Psychoanalysis tries to give you this freedom. Freedom from the past traumas, childhood wounds. Primal therapy is based basically on the past. You have to go backwards to free you from the past. You have to reach to the first primal scream. Then you will be free. So freedom means for primal therapy, for psychoanalysis and for other therapies, that the past has to be dropped. You have to fight with it. You have to somehow manage disentangling yourself from the past. Then you will be free. As far as this freedom is concerned, Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud are not opposed to each other. They both agree. Karl Marx says one has to become free from the past. All past social structures, economic structures. His approach is political. Freud's approach is psychological. But both are rooted in the idea of freedom from. All political reforms are reactions. And when you react, you are never free. This has to be understood. It only gives you an appearance of freedom, but it is never true freedom. Out of reaction, total freedom is not possible. Out of reaction, true freedom is not possible. And total freedom only is true freedom. You can go against the past, but just in being against it, you are caught by it from the back door. That's why it has happened again and again. That with whomsoever you are fighting, you become like him. Choose your enemies very carefully. Because you will be determined by them. Fighting with them, you will have to learn their strategies. Obviously, you will have to learn their tactics. You will have to learn their ways. Slowly, slowly, enemies become very alike, more alike than friends. It happened in Soviet Russia. When the revolution came and the communists changed the whole socialist structure, the Tsar was killed. A strange phenomenon came into existence. The people who had killed the Tsar turned out to be greater Tsars than Tsars themselves. Joseph Stalin proved to be far more terrible than Ivan the Terrible. Ivan is nothing compared to Joseph Stalin. And it is a natural phenomenon. I am not blaming Joseph Stalin at all. I can understand what really happened. If you fight with the Tsar, you have to learn his ways. And by the time you are the winner, you have learned the ways so skillfully, so efficiently, they have become your ways. You start practicing the same on your enemies. Every revolution, that's why, has failed. Persons change, but the structures remain the same. Because the idea of freedom from is basically wrong. The second idea is freedom for. It is future oriented. The first is political. The second is more poetic, visionary, utopian. Many people have tried that too. But that too is not possible. Because future oriented. You can't live in the present. You have to live in the present. You don't live in the past, you don't live in the future, you have to live in the present. Visionaries only imagine. Beautiful utopias they have imagined. But those utopias never become reality, cannot become reality. If you react to the past, you are determined by the past. If you forget the past and look at the future, you are still determined by the past, just you are not aware of it. Looking at the future, you dream beautiful dreams, but they can't change reality. The reality remains the same. Dreams are very ineffective, impotent. The first freedom from is a reaction. The second freedom for is revolution. The third just freedom is rebellion. It is present oriented. The first is political, the second is poetic. The third is mystic, religious. What do I mean when I say just freedom? Neither for nor against. No past, no future. Just being here now. Just living moment to moment with no ideology. With no utopia. The real sannyasin, the real mystic, is not against the past, is not for the future. He is so utterly absorbed by the present that he has no time, no energy for the past and the future. This is how the rebel is born. The rebel is the most beautiful phenomenon in the world. Buddha is a rebel. So is Jesus. Atisha is a rebel. So is Kabir. These are rebels. You will misunderstand them if you think about them. As if they were revolutionaries, they were not. Neither they were reactionaries. Their orientation is totally different. Their orientation is now, here. They don't live for any ideal. And they don't live against any ideal. They don't have any ideals. No ideology exists in their consciousness. The sheer purity of this moment, they live it, they enjoy it, they sing it, they dance it, and when the next moment comes, they live the next moment with the same joy, with the same cheerfulness. They move moment to moment. They don't plan ahead. That's why in the East, where mystics have been a great force, nothing like communism has happened. The idea is Western. The idea cannot be conceived to have happened to the Eastern consciousness. And nothing like future utopias, Moore's utopia, or other utopias. There are so many utopian socialists. Nothing like that has happened either. But something totally different. A Buddha, a Atisha, individuals living moment to moment in such sheer joy that their joy is contagious. Whosoever comes in their contact is overwhelmed. It starts looking at reality with new eyes. They give you a new insight into the here now. This is just freedom. Meditate over it. There is no need for any psychology either. That's why psychology has not happened in the East. There is no need to go into the past traumas. And in fact, even if you go into the past traumas, you are never free of them. Maybe you become more accepting, more understanding, but you are never free of them. Whatsoever the founder of primal therapy, Arthur Jeneau, says about the post-primal man, he has not been able to create a single post-primal man. He himself is not a post-primal man. Totally free from the past, totally free from the past wounds. It is not possible. The way it is done by psychoanalysis and kindred therapies, it is not possible. The past is not there. From what you are trying to get free, In fact, under the impact of a charismatic psychotherapist, you start creating a past according to him. This happens. If you go to the Freudian, you create a Freudian past. And if you go to the Jungian, you create a Jungian past. Now this is a well-known fact that the patients start creating, fantasizing the past that is expected by the therapist. The Jungian patient starts going into past lives very easily. And starts bringing great mysteries, esoteric, occult. It never happened to any patient with Freud. The Freudian patient brings what Freud expects, libido, sexual fantasies, strange sexual fantasies, incest, and all kinds of sexual wounds. They never surface in a Jungian psychotherapy. And the primal patient starts bringing screams which may not have any reality. But people are very obliging. If you give them an idea, they oblige you by fulfilling it. In fact, the patient starts feeling very, very compassionate on the therapist. He is working so hard, poor fellow. So sooner or later, he starts obliging. Now there are hundreds of psychotherapies in the West. And each psychotherapist becomes convinced that he is right. His patients befool him. And the same patients go to another psychotherapist and they befool the other two. The patients are playing a great game. And that is happening unconsciously. Mind is so vast, you can always choose few fragments which will be satisfying to a particular philosophy, to a particular psychology, to a particular therapy. Man is a vast continent. Man is not a small phenomenon. It can contain many Freuds, many Jungs, many Adlers. And you can always choose. There is so much in you that you can always find ways of choosing certain fragments which fit with the therapy you are going through. The East has not created anything like communism, and it has not created anything like psychoanalysis for a certain reason. The reason is that the mystic is not trying to be free from the past. The mystic is not trying to be free for something in the future. The mystic's effort for freedom, what he calls moksha, total freedom, has nothing to do with that which is no more and has nothing to do with that which is not yet. His whole concern is this moment, this small, crystal clear moment. And to be in this moment is to be in meditation. To be utterly in this moment is to be in meditation. And when meditation happens, you will see two wings growing in you. One will be of love, Atisa calls it compassion. Another will be a freedom. And they both will start growing together. This brings fulfillment. Then there is no grudge, no regret. Atisa is right. He says, now, even when I die, I will have no regret. Life has been a fulfillment. I have known its mysteries. I have loved. I have lived in freedom. I have known all that was needed to be contented. I am utterly fulfilled. Life has been fruitful. Life has not been a wastage. It has been a constant enrichment. And I have bloomed. And the lotus has opened. To die with your inner lotus fully in bloom. To die in love, in freedom, is the proof that one has known life, is the proof that one has really lived. All others only go through empty gestures. They are not living. You should find freedom by means of both examination and investigation. How to find this freedom? How to find this essential core of your being? It happens in meditation. Atisa calls meditation awareness. And awareness has to be developed. It is only a seed in you. It can become a tree. And two things he suggests will be helpful. One is examination and the other is investigation. Examination means never allow anything to pass your mind without observing it minutely. Socrates is reported to have said that a life is worthless if you have not lived it through examination. An unexamined life is a worthless life. Examination is the first step. Becoming alert what passes your mind. And there is constant traffic. So many thoughts, so many desires, so many dreams are passing by. You have to be watchful. You have to examine each and everything that passes through the mind. Not a single thought should pass unawares, because that means you were asleep. Become more and more observant. And the second step is investigation. First observe, examine, and then start looking into the roots. Why a certain thing happens again and again? You become angry again and again. Examination will simply show you that anger comes and goes. Investigation will show you the roots of anger, from where it comes. Because it may be, it is almost so, that anger is only a symptom of something else which is hidden. It may be your ego that feels hurt and you become angry. But the ego keeps itself hiding underground. It is like roots of the trees. You see the foliage, but you don't see the roots. By examination, you will see the tree. By investigation, you will see the roots. And it is only by seeing the roots that a transformation is possible. Bring the roots to the light and the tree starts dying. If you can find the root of your anger, you will be surprised that the anger starts disappearing. If you can find the root of your sadness, you will be again surprised. First, examine what is constantly there in your mind. What is being repeated again and again? You don't have many thoughts. If you examine minutely, you will see that you have only few thoughts repeated again and again. Maybe in new forms, new colors, new garments, new masks, but you have only very few thoughts. And if you minutely go into it, you will be surprised. You have a basic one thought. Gurdjieff used to say to his disciples that first find out your main characteristic. And each person has a main characteristic. It may be greed. It may be anger. It may be sex. It may be something else, jealousy. Find out which is the main characteristic, which is the center around which all your thoughts and moods move. If you can find the center, you have found the root. And the miracle is that once the root is found, you need not cut it. It is cut in the very finding of it. This is the inner secret of transformation. Watch. Again and again you become sad. Suddenly, out of nowhere, everything was going good and something clicks and you become sad. And again it is gone and by the evening it is back. And so on and so forth. Why this happens? First examine, then investigate. And by examination and investigation, the quality called awareness will be born in you. And once awareness is there, you have the source which can cut all the roots of all the diseases. And once awareness is born, slowly, slowly you will see you are getting out of the past and out of the future. And you are entering in the present. You are becoming more present to the present. You are attaining to a kind of presence which was never there. You are becoming luminous. And in this presence, when you can feel the moment passing by, all your senses will become so pure, so sensitive, so sensuous, so alert and alive that the whole life will take a new intensity. You will attain to a great zestfulness. The world will be the same and yet not the same. The trees will look greener. The roses rosier. The people more alive, more beautiful. the same world. And the pebbles on the shore start looking like diamonds and emeralds. When awareness is very, very deep rooted, when you are present to the present, you attain to a psychedelic vision of life. That's why mystics talk of so much beauty and you don't find it. Mystics talk of immense celebration going on and you don't see any celebration anywhere. Mystics talk of great music, but you don't hear any music. And the mystics are right. The great music is passing by, but you are deaf. The great beauty is all around, but you are blind. The whole existence is celebrating this very moment as much as it was celebrating when Atisha was alive. Existence is celebration. But your heart is dead. Only your physical heart is beating. Your spiritual heart is completely non-functioning. And without it, you will not be able to see the celebration of life. And how you can feel grateful to God if you don't see the celebration? How you can feel thankful to God if you don't see the gift? For what to be thankful? You can only be full of complaints, regrets, grudges. You can only be angry at existence, that why you have been created. Why this suffering? You see only suffering. Because your eyes can only see suffering. Otherwise, existence is a blessing, a benediction. The second sutra, don't brag. Atisha is really beautiful, very telegraphic. His sutras look as if he is taking quantum jumps, seem to be unrelated. They are not. There is an inner relationship. Because when this psychedelic vision will happen to you, you will start bragging. When this awareness will happen to you, the last but one assault of the ego is bound to happen too. It is inevitable. You will start feeling holier than thou. You will start moving like a saint. You will start feeling, exhibiting that you are not an ordinary mortal, that you are extraordinary, that you are not of this world, that you are transcendental. And although all these things are right, Atisha says, please don't brag. He is not saying that you are lying. All these things are true. When awareness happens, miracles start happening. Each moment becomes such a miracle. And you start soaring high. You start attaining to new peaks in everything. Whatsoever you do becomes such a delight. And wherever you move, life appears to be so divine. And you can see that too. That wherever you move, you bring a certain sacredness to the place. Not that these are lies, these are happening. But if you start bragging, all these things will disappear. because the ego has entered in such a subtle way, and you could not examine it, and you could not investigate it. Ego will ride on your spiritual experiences now. One has to be now very careful. The non-meditator can be careless. He can afford to be careless because he has nothing to lose. But the meditator cannot be careless. He has much to lose. Treasures are there now, and they can be lost within a second. When you start moving to the higher realms, you can fall very easily. And the fall is going to be great. If you fall walking on the MG road, there is not much danger. But if you fall from Everest, it is very dangerous. You may not survive at all. So those who start moving in the world of meditation has to learn to be very careful. The path is narrow. And just by the side of the path, the great abyss. A single wrong step and you will fall. And you will fall badly. And it may take years or even lives for you to attain to the same height again. And if you fall once from a certain space, the tendency is that again you will fall from the same space. That becomes your habit. My observation is this, that meditators learn habits of falling from a certain stage always. So whenever that stage again is there, they fall. Great effort is needed to reach again, but now it becomes a point that the mind suddenly takes the wrong step, habitually, mechanically. So it is better to be aware when for the first time you are moving high. So no habit of fall is created in you. Don't brag. The spiritual experiences should not be talked. If a great need arises in you to talk about it, you can go to your master. You can share with your master. There is no danger in it. Because sharing with the master is always helpful. In the first place, whatsoever you bring to the master, he will make you feel that this is nothing. Don't be stupid. This is just bullshit. Forget all about it. Even if you bring nirvana to him, he will say, this is nothing. Throw it out. Leave it where you leave your shoes. Even nirvana. That is one of the secrets of the master to work on the disciple. He will never pat your back. He will never say, great. So you are great, you have attained. Secondly, he will always make you beware that experiences, howsoever beautiful, are still experiences. And the real is not that which is experienced, but the one who experiences. his emphasis will always be towards the witness, towards the inner subjectivity, not towards the object. Somebody sees great light, and it is really a great rejoicing when you see inner light. You don't walk on the earth. You are so delighted. You lose all weight. Gravitation no more functions on you. You feel as if you want, you can fly. But if you go to the master, he will say, "So what? This happens to everybody. This is nothing special. Others are doing far better." And this is only an experience. An experience means something outside. Remember the experiencer. Remember the one who is experiencing the light. You are not it. You are the witness of it. Yes, light is there, but you are not it. You are the one who has seen the light. Remember the seer. The masters are great artists in pulling legs. You may go standing upright and they will pull your leg and you will fall flat on the ground. And next time when some great spiritual experience happens, you will be afraid even to go to the master and tell about it. This is very essential. And the second thing, there are things, if you talk about them, if you start exhibiting them, the energy that is needed to nourish them starts moving in exhibiting them. The seed needs to be hidden in the soil. It should not be brought out again and again. If you bring it out, you will kill it. And these spiritual experiences are like great seeds. The disciple has to learn the art of keeping secrets. This is one of the very essential parts of being with a master, the capacity to keep secrets. I have heard a man was in search of a master who has attained to the ultimate secret. He went to many but was frustrated, finally disappointed. Then he heard that deep, far away in the desert, there is an old man who has attained to the ultimate secret. But to persuade him is very difficult. He does not accept disciples easily. This man was challenged. He sold all that he had and he traveled to the desert. It took 3 years for him to reach, utterly tired, weary of the whole search. Many times had decided to turn back, but it was against his ego, the ego of the seeker. What people will say, back home they will laugh and they will say, "We had told you before." So he persisted, persevered, and finally reached. And yes, the old man had something. He had seen many, many masters, but all bogus, hocus pocus. This man had something, it was so apparent, it was so transparent. He looked into the eyes of the old man and he saw such depth that he has never seen. The old man was sitting under a tree. And the whole vibe around the tree was so immense that the man was overwhelmed. He started feeling drunk. He fell into the feet of the old man and he said, I have come to find the ultimate secret. Can you tell it to me? And the master said, then for 3 years you will have to be silent. Not a single word to be uttered. Serve me for 3 years in absolute silence. If you can manage that, then I can tell you the secret. Because the secret has to be kept secret. If you can manage silence for 3 years, that will be an indication that you are capable of keeping something within yourself. The man agreed. Those 3 years were really long, almost like three lives. Desert, nobody else, just this old man, and silence. The silence of the desert, the silence of the old man, and 3 years. Appeared as if many, many years have passed. When the 3 years were over, the man asked, now sir, 3 years are over. Tell me the secret. The master said, now you have to make a promise that you will never tell this secret to anybody. Never, never. An absolute promise is needed. The man said, I promise. I promise to you, I promise to God with my whole heart that never I will reveal this secret to anybody. The old man started laughing. He said, that's good. So what do you think? If you can keep it a secret for your whole life, cannot I? This is the promise that I have given to my own master. I cannot reveal it. But I will tell you one thing, he said. The same thing had happened with my master. 3 years I had remained silent. And it was as long as it has been long to you. And then the day had come and I was so happy that 3 years I have kept silent. And exactly the same thing had happened. I asked him about the secret and he said, a promise that you will never reveal the secret to anybody. And I promised and he laughed the way I have laughed. And he said, so what do you think? If you can keep it a secret, cannot I? So in fact, there is no secret. The whole art is of keeping it. It is not a question of the secret. My own understanding is that the same has been happening again and again. This must have happened with my master and his master and so on and so forth. There seems to be no secret. But we have learned a lot by keeping it. See the point. If you can keep a secret, whether the secret is worth keeping or not, that is not the point. Whether there is a secret or not, that is not the point. The master may have whispered in your ear that 2 + 2 = 4. Now keep it a secret. That will do. It is not a question of what it is. The question is, can you keep something inside you? Just the other night, I was telling to Radha that now you have to keep this a secret. And I have not told any secret to her. And she has promised. Yes, she said, I will keep. And I told her that you are a gossip. One of the greatest gossipers in the commune. So you have to keep it a secret. And she has promised. I don't know what secret she has promised for. But now she has to keep it. The art is in keeping it. Don't brag. Don't exhibit. A natural tendency of the mind is to exhibit. And when you have something special, for example, you can read somebody's thoughts. It is very natural to go and show it to people. Once a Mohammedan young man was with me for many years. A very stubborn fellow. And whatsoever I will give him to do, he will put his whole energy into it. And then one day, it happened that he started reading people's thoughts. It was very difficult for me to keep him silent about it. And this is trespass to read anybody's thoughts. It is entering into his privacy. Because I told him to keep it to himself, never practice it. So he kept it. Out of keeping it a secret and not exhibiting and not practicing it, another quality arose out of it. That he became able to put a thought in your mind very easily, without your knowing. And whatsoever he would like to put in your mind, you will immediately act accordingly. He became a kind of Delgado. And without any electrodes. Suddenly he discovered it. I had sent him for a journey. He was sitting in a bus. And just the idea suddenly came in his mind. If he can read people's thoughts, cannot he put a thought in somebody's mind? Out of nowhere. And because I had not told anything about it to him, he tried. He just tried with the person who was sitting in the seat ahead of him. That fall down from your seat. And the man fell down. He himself was shocked, but then he thought it may be just a coincidence. The man was just going to fall down. So he tried on another. And again it happened. He became so afraid. And the idea started torturing him. Why not take the whole bus down the hills? That he had to stop the driver and get down from the bus in the middle of the journey. He came back to me and he said, this is very dangerous. I tried on 2 persons, it worked. And then the idea came to me, why not try with the whole bus? If you enter into the world of meditation, these are the small things which start happening. Avoid, never use them, never exhibit, and don't talk about them. Because if you talk, people will ask, now show some proof. If you talk about them, they will ask for the proof. And then you will start practicing them. And soon you will lose the energy. The energy is needed for inner nourishment. When something is growing in you, the whole energy has to be turned into manure. Don't use it outside in any way. The best way to begin is don't brag. The third sutra, don't be consumed by jealousy. Now you will be at a loss to find the relationship, but there is. Atisha is saying that you may not brag, but others may brag, then jealousy will arise. Others may start showing their spiritual powers. And by showing their spiritual powers, they may be worshipped by people, respected by people, thought to be great saints. And you are holding a secret in your heart, and you know you can do greater miracles than they can do. And now they are being worshipped by people, and nobody knows anything about you. You are just a nobody. Jealousy may arise. And if jealousy arises, that is the negative part of bragging. Then sooner or later you will start bragging. One more point to be understood. It happens that when for the first time a meditator attains to some psychic energy, some psychic power, the tendency, natural tendency is to exhibit it. And if he exhibits, sooner or later he will lose the power. And then the problem arises, a great problem. He cannot do it now. And now he has respectability. He is worshipped. And people expect him to do miracles. Now what he is going to do? He will have to turn to magic. He will have to start learning tricks to maintain his prestige. That's what happened to Satya Sai Baba and people like that. The first thing that they had done was real. First few experiments that they had done were not phony. But then energy disappears. And by the time you have become famous, and people start gathering, foolish people, stupid people, and they expect you. And your whole ego depends on your exhibition. Now the only possible alternative is to learn magic tricks so that you can go on maintaining your prestige. If you brag, sooner or later you will become a victim of magical tricks. You will have to learn and deceive people. Don't be jealous, because if you are jealous, it will be impossible for you to keep the secret long. And the fourth, don't act capriciously. Don't irritate people unnecessarily. By pretending to be holier than others. By pretending to be saintly. By pretending to be special. Don't irritate people. Don't act in such ways. Why? Because difficulties are going to arise on their own. You don't, please, add to them. Your very presence is going to create troubles for you. So at least avoid as much as possible to irritate people. If you pretend to be holier, then you will create competitors. If you pretend that you are special, then there will be others who will deny. Argumentations will arise. Unnecessary controversies, enmities. And Atisha is saying this for a very special reason. The special reason is that the very presence of a person who has some spiritual quality is enough to create trouble for him. Because the blind people don't like people with eyes. Those who have lived always in darkness don't like people who bring light to them. They hate them. Because the presence of a man of light is insulting. It makes them feel inferior. And this happens on its own accord. So please don't in any way do anything to enhance it more. Even if you keep everything secret, few people are going to know about it. Its presence is such. Few people are bound to find you. Even if you escape to the Himalayas, few people are bound to search and seek you. Because there are seekers. There are people who are very sensitive. There are people who are looking for lives, for something to happen in their life. You will become known. There is no need to brag. There is no need to be jealous. You try to hide yourself as much as you can. Still you will become known. You cannot hide a light underneath a bush. It will show. You cannot hide a light. It will radiate. And once seekers start gathering around you, and disciples come, and devotees come, the society at large is going to be very irritated with you. The society is going to be angry with you. The society will try to destroy you and your whole work and your whole commune. Why? Because you are undermining the society. You are cutting its very roots. It lives in ambition and you are teaching a non-ambitious life. It lives in Machiavellian ways and you are teaching the ways of the Buddha. It lives through jealousy, violence, possessiveness and you are teaching love. You are undermining its very foundation. You are destroying its very roots. It cannot forgive you. It will take revenge. So it is better to be very cautious. Don't expect thanks. It is natural. When you attain closer and closer to God, it is very natural to feel that people will be thankful to you. You are bringing a gift to them. The greatest gift there is, the gift of God. It is very natural to feel that people will be thankful to you. Don't expect it. Expect just the contrary, that people will never be able to forgive you. The greater gift you bring to them, the greater will be their anger. They will crucify you, they will poison you. Expect things like that. Even Jesus was not expecting that so much torture is going to be done to him. That so much suffering is going to be created for him. From the cross he had shouted to God, "Have you forsaken me? Why? Why this is happening to me? What wrong have I done?" Deep down somewhere, he was not expecting that crucifixion is going to happen. Atisa is very clear in his advices to his disciples. Don't expect things. On the contrary, expect that people will be angry, irritated, revengeful. They will become antagonistic to you. Hope for the best and expect the worst. If they don't kill you, be thankful to them. A disciple of Buddha was going to spread his master's word. Buddha asked him where you would be going, to what direction, to what province. And he said that he is going to a remote corner of Bihar. It was called Sukha. Because no other disciple of yours has ever gone to that part. Buddha said, before you decide, answer three questions. First, do you know the people of that province are very, very violent, easily irritable, murderous? It is dangerous to go to them. That's why no other disciple has even thought of going to them. If they insult you, and they are going to insult you, how you are going to respond? What will happen in your heart? And the disciple said, you know perfectly well what will happen into my heart. Because you know my heart. Because you are my heart. Why such unnecessary questions? But because you ask, I have to answer. If they insult me, deep down in my heart, I will feel thankful to them that they only insult me. They could have beaten. Buddha said, now the second question. They will beat you. You are going to be beaten. Then what will happen to you? Then what you will think? And the disciple said, you know perfectly well, I will be thankful to them. Because I will think they are only beating me. They could have killed me. Buddha said, now the third question. They can kill you. And if they kill you, what will happen to you? What you will think in your heart? And the disciple said, you know perfectly well, you are unnecessarily asking me. But because you ask, I have to answer. If they kill me, while I am being killed, I will be thankful. Because they have given me a beautiful opportunity, the greatest challenge. Can you be thankful even to those who are killing you? The greatest challenge. And I will be thankful to them because they are killing me and taking my life away from me. A life in which I may have committed something wrong. Now there is no possibility. I will never commit anything wrong. A life in which I may have fallen from my awareness. Now they are taking that life away from me. I cannot fall from my awareness anymore. I will be thankful to them, utterly thankful, because when somebody is being killed, if he can remain alert, that is his last life. He will not be coming back to the earth. I will think they are my friends. They are delivering me from bondage. I will always remember them with tremendous gratitude in my heart. Buddha said, now you can go wherever you want, because wherever you will go, you will be able to radiate my energy. You will be able to share my love and my compassion. And you will be able to make people alert, aware. You are ready. Atisha says, don't expect thanks. On the contrary, be thankful if something wrong is being done to you. That is natural. You should know well. You should expect it. If it doesn't happen, that is a miracle. If Jesus is not crucified, if Socrates is not poisoned, if Mahavira is not beaten again and again, if many efforts and attempts are not made on Buddha's life, that will be a miracle. These things have to be expected. That's how the greater humanity lives in darkness, in such darkness. From their darkness, you cannot expect more. This quintessential elixir of advice, by which the advancement of the five decays is changed into the Bodhi path, is transmitted through Dharma Kirti. The original master is Gautam the Buddha. But Atisha's master is Dharma Kirti. The disciple never forgets the master, even when he himself becomes enlightened. Then to his gratitude remains. In fact, it grows. It becomes total, absolute. he remembers his master Dharmakirti. It was Dharmakirti who told him to go to Dharmarakshita to learn something more. And it was Dharmakirti who told him that after Dharmarakshita, you go to Yogin Mitre to learn something more. But he was following the guidance of his master Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti is one of the very famous Buddhist masters. His many disciples became enlightened. Atisai is only one of his disciples, but the most famous. He says, this quintessential elixir of advice, this nectar that I have poured into the previous sutras, has nothing to do with me. I am not the author of these sutras. These truths were transmitted to me from my master. And they were transmitted to my master from his master. Originally, they come from Gautama the Buddha. These sutras are not mine, he is saying. They don't have my signature on them. I am just a vehicle, a medium, transmitting whatsoever has been given to me. I am instrumental. See the egolessness of the person and remember it. And what is the quint essential elixir of this whole advice? That is how to transform the five decays into the Bodhi path. What are the five decays? Meditate on two states. One is the state of sleep in which the greater humanity is. People are living like somnambulists. Mechanical is their life, unconscious is their behavior. They are not aware who they are not aware what they are doing, they are not aware where they are going. Their life is accidental, a driftwood. In this state, also bodhicitta, Buddha consciousness, or Christ consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, whatsoever name you choose, you can choose, exists. Even in those people who are perfectly asleep, not even a glimpse of awareness, bodhicitta exists. The Buddha consciousness exists. But it is covered in rubbish. And the rubbish comes from five senses, the eyes, the ears, and the other senses. The senses go on pouring into you all kinds of impressions from the outside. Whatsoever you see immediately reaches inside. Whatsoever you read reaches inside. Whatsoever you hear reaches inside. And your bodhicitta is like a diamond covered with layers and layers of impressions. This is one state. Whatsoever these five senses bring to you are going to be taken away by death. Because whatsoever comes from without, death will disconnect you. It can never become part of you. It remains apart. It remains a foreign element in you. It never becomes your nature. The second state is of the awakened one, the Buddha, the enlightened one, who is absolutely alert. A transformation happens in him. He also has five senses, but now his five senses function in a totally different way. His five senses start pouring his compassion to the outside world. To the person who is asleep, the five senses bring only impressions from the outside. To the person who is awake, these same five senses start pouring his love, his energy, his compassion into the world. When bodhicitta is discovered, when inner consciousness is known, you are no more a beggar. You don't take anything from without. On the contrary, you become an emperor. You start pouring your being into the outside world. You beautify it. You become a blessing to it. This is the transformation. If you are alert, you will give something to the world. You will be a giver. And remember, the more you give, the more you have. Because the more you pour into the world, from the unknown sources of existence, more and more goes on flowing into you. You are connected with the oceanic. The bodhicitta is the door of the oceanic. That ocean is God. From that ocean, springs go on flowing into you. You just share. Jesus says, those who will save will lose. And those who will lose will save. Share and you will have more. Give. And you will get from the beyond. The transformed person is continuously giving. He has so much to give. He is overflowing. This quintessential elixir advice, by which the advancement of the five decays is changed into the Bodhi path, is transmitted through Dharmakirti. My master Dharmakirti, Atisa says, has given me this secret of transforming the energies, their direction. Now the five senses are no more accumulating unnecessary rubbish, which is going to decay and stink. But now they have become passages of an overflowing divine energy. By awakening the karmic energy of previous training and by virtue of my intense interest, I ignored misery and bad reputation and sought instruction to control ego clinging. He is saying I could find Dharmakirti only because of my past searches. For lives I have been searching. And the same I say to you. You are not new people. You are ancient seekers. Otherwise, there are people living in the neighborhood who have not even seen me and who will never see and who will never hear and who will never know what is happening here. Just living few feet away, and they will not know that something of immense value is happening here. And you have come from farther, far, far away, corners of the world. You must have been seeking for many lives. You have gathered a certain energy that knows where the Buddha field is, and you are attracted towards that Buddha field. You know where the magnet is. By awakening the karmic energy of previous training, he said, it must have been because in my past lives I have been disciplining myself in many ways, that I must have gathered a certain karmic energy that I could find the master, that I was fortunate enough to find the master. And by virtue of my intense interest, my passionate desire to know the truth, only two things are needed: energy to seek and passionate interest to put that energy into a certain direction. I ignored misery and bad reputation. When you come to a master, and the master is really a master, the society will be against you. The society will create misery for you. You will have to suffer many kinds of things, bad reputation. I ignored misery and bad reputation. It must have been because of my past karmic energy. It must have been because for many lives I have been seeking and searching. Everybody is an ancient pilgrim. I ignored misery and bad reputation. It is very difficult to ignore misery and bad reputation. Now for my sannyasins, I am creating 1001 kinds of difficulties. The world will be against you. Wherever you will go, you will have a bad reputation. Just to be associated with me will be enough for people to condemn you, ridicule you. Think of you as you are mad or something. Only those who are real seekers will be able to ignore all this misery and bad reputation. Those who are just curious, they will not be able to do it. Only the fortunate ones, only the courageous ones, only the true seekers will be able to ignore everything, will be able to sacrifice everything, will be able to stake everything. Once you have come in contact with a living master, then all else is meaningless, can be staked, can be easily sacrificed. And sought instruction to control ego clinging. I dropped the people. I ignored what they say. Instead, I poured my whole energy into one thing: how to drop this idea of ego, how to drop ego clinging. All these sutras are nothing but the whole science of destroying ego. Once the ego is no more there, once you are no more separate from existence, once you don't think yourself as separate from existence, immediately you are enlightened. Here the ego disappears, there God appears immediately, instantly. Now, even when I die, I will have no regrets. I hope my sannyasins will also be able to say that one day. Now, even when I die, I will have no regrets. It is possible only if bodhicitta is attained. It is possible only if you have come to know your innermost essential core. And that it is not personal. And that it is universal. And that it is not mortal. And that it is immortal. That it has nothing to do with time and space. That it is eternity itself. Amratasya putra. We are sons of immortality. Once you have known it, life is not a regret. Life is a blessing, a benediction. Meditate on Atisha. Listen to his advice. It is of immense value. It is not a philosophy. It is a manual to discipline yourself. It is a manual of inner transformation. It is the book that can help you grow into wisdom. I call it the book of wisdom. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.